Greetings and salutations, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Voices That Cook. I am your host, William Nunn, who is a voice actor who likes to cook, and I like to bring people on the show who are voice actors who also like to cook. And I know I say this a lot on the show, that I have a special guest on, but I have a very special guest on today that I've been really hoping to have on this show for quite some time now. I'm glad I finally got her on. You likely know her from her baking content, her theater content, and especially Hori Mia. Please welcome, I'm going to make sure I pronounce your name correctly, Celeste Perez.
Yes.
Wonderful. I got it on the first try. I'm used to reading it, but saying it out loud in front of you, I wanted to make sure that was all well and good. But one thing I will let all of you know before we continue further, she is also starring in anime called The Saint's Magic Power is Omnipotent. So
Yes. Definitely
give that a whirl when you can on Funimation, because that's also a character you play as that likes to cook too. So we will definitely be talking about that some, which, full disclosure, I've only seen the first two episodes.
That's fair.
it's definitely a show that I feel like you should definitely watch, but I guess the word I'm trying to say is it probably wasn't written for somebody like me, but I wanted to check it out because you were starring in it.
Oh, and, thank you.
And I just wanted to hear how good you would be in it, because I'm sure some people have probably told you over the last year or so, they've probably been like, they got to be aware of the great performances you can do through Hori Mia, and I'm one of them. Like, I was really impressed with your performance as Sakura, and especially that crying scene. Just we'll touch on that later, but I'm just that was where I was like, I would love to, you know, tell her how good she is.
Oh.
But then I see all of the baking content you do, and it's like, okay, we gotta be friends because we love to cook.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm so glad that I can't remember if you reached out to me or if I reached out to you and I was like, hey, I'm a voice actor that likes to cook. I like to bake. Let's talk. Let's be friends. Because I guess a year ago I was, you know, Hori Mia was my first anime that I ever did, which is kind of scary to say out loud. But I was just so excited to be a part of the voice acting world that, you know, I've met so many good friends and so many people that do this. And I. So it was great meeting another voice actor that likes to cook.
Oh, yes. And it's pretty surreal seeing that there's so many that like to cook, whether it's Suling Chan, Jun Yoon, Aaron Nicole Lundquist. There's so many people that are in what we do that also enjoy making food as much as we do, if not more so on some occasions. But you at least have your own baking service. Like, you've got your own shop and everything, which I would really like to let the audience know more about that, if you'd like to talk about that some.
Yeah, well, actually, I'm so sorry. I recently had to close down my baking business.
Oh,
this is
no!
Really sad. I'm really sorry. I've only shared it on the Facebook page that it's on. And I closed down the website. I'm so sorry. This is so sad. But I was going to get into this later, but I was diagnosed with an autoimmune disease in November. And a really big part of my treatment plan for just reaching remission is a major lifestyle change. And I basically can't have anything baked because I not only can I not have dairy, I can't have sugar unless it's honey or it can be made with dates or something. But I also can't do like processed grains. So baking is pretty much like I had to stop doing that, which is really, really sad. But I'm still considering the ways that I can use my knowledge and my supplies and, you know, like not have to totally quit cold turkey on the thing that I spent so much time working on being good at, you know, that brought me so much joy. So I'm still trying. There's something in the works. I don't really know what it is yet, but there's something in the works in the future that hopefully I'll be able to continue using this knowledge and my all of the tools that I bought over the last 2 years. Yeah.
Gotcha. Well, my condolences on that.
I'm so sorry I didn't tell you that before we started.
All good. We're going to probably have a couple of awkward moments here anyway, because when we were initially going to have this interview in an earlier time, I went ahead and wrote down some notes just so that they would be things I'd bring up to you. And two of them, I completely forgot why I wrote them down. So maybe you could elaborate.
Sure.
So this will also kind of tie into the whole voice acting half of the show. So we're going to start off with, because the first note I have on here is a 45-minute monologue. Does that ring any bells?
45-minute monologue. Maybe? I don't know what that is.
I don't know either.
I did a one-person show over the summer, but that was a live performance.
And that didn't last 45 minutes.
It might have been.
It could have.
It could have been 30 to 45 minutes. But I don't know. I don't know if you would know about that. I don't know. 45-minute monologue. Gosh.
That could have been it, probably.
I don't think I ever did one in an episode.
Well, I remember seeing something, and this is what my brain is now telling me this. There is something I remember you doing that was like basically kind of you doing a long performance, and you did it within a very short amount of time as far as preparation was concerned. And I just remember being very impressed by that. So I was actually quite curious, because not only have you had time as a voice actor, but you've done theater and all that. So it allowed you, obviously, I'm sure that helped a lot with that training. But I find it amazing to think about where you could have a very short amount of time to prepare for something, and all of a sudden go up on stage and be able to essentially just perform and do it with so much to already work with before, even if it's 20 minutes, I'd be like, holy crap, you want me to know all that in 24 hours?
Oh, yeah.
How do you do that?
Oh, yeah. I actually did, like, so obviously I have been a stage performer professionally since I got out of college in 2016, but that's what I went to college for, and high school as well. There's an arts magnet high school here in Dallas that's it's pretty popular. Nora Jones went there. So did a lot of other people. Erykah Badu was there. Edie Brickell. But I've been a stage actor for a really long time. But obviously, because of the pandemic, I was out of work from, like, I think my last show was in February of 2020. And then I did Zoom and voice acting until my first live performance was in May. I think it was either in May or June. And for the first few months of returning to performance, everything that I did, like I did four or five different productions that were minimally rehearsed. I'm not sure if people know this, but there's among the Funimation people in Dallas and the stage actors in Dallas, there are a few different companies, smaller companies, that do minimally rehearsed Shakespeare. And that's actually how I met, it's not how I met Caitlin Glass or Sean Gann or, Marcus Stimmick has one. There are a few other Funimation actors, a lot of Funimation actors actually that do this, but we do minimally rehearsed Shakespeare. They go by a few different names. There's one called Shakespeare in the Bar. Caitlin Glass and I did Two Gentlemen of Verona, and Taylor Harris, who is also in Saints Magic Powers Omnipotent. He was the director in that. And I did Midsummer Night's Dream. Sean Gann was in that. Caitlin Glass was in it. Marissa was in it.
Yes.
Matthew Holmes was in it. Marcus was our director, and he also played Bottom. It was a production of Midsummer, and I was Titania. It was one of the best things I've ever done. It was just so much fun. And, you know, with these shows, we only get 3 or 4 rehearsals, and they're not mandatory. I mean, everybody shows up to at least one, usually. But, you know, I think for Two Gentlemen of Verona, I only went to 2 rehearsals. And I think for Midsummer, we might have had 5 rehearsals. But that's still like a full-length Shakespeare play done in verse, where it's very DIY. We make our own costumes. We make our own props, or Marcus might bring some in. He and his brother Michael are amazing at just creating magical, fun worlds with fun props. And they're just an incredible 2 people to work with. I'm trying to think about what else. It's so hard to remember what I've done since returning to performing. But I also did do a 1-person show with Shakespeare Dallas, which is a company I've worked with for the last few years. I've always been a big fan of them. I've been watching their performances since I was a kid. They did a show called The Hamlet Project. And The Hamlet Project is, it was a commissioned piece. They brought in 2 different playwrights to write solo performances based on Hamlet. And they brought in like 12, 13, 14 performers. And we only had 24 hours with the script before going on. Like, the way it would work was, we were hired, you know, a couple of months out. So they were like, you've got 2 months to study Hamlet as well as you can so that you can be as prepared as possible. But that's the most amount of preparation you're going to get. And 24 hours before going on, which I was called at 7 p.m., so 7 p.m. the day before, I would get a call from the producer, and she would say, hey, I'm outside of your place, and I've got a tub of props and your script. And I'm going to tell you, oh, and they wouldn't tell you which script you had.
So
everybody would have 1 of 2 scripts. And 2 performers would perform each night. So one person, so, the audience would get to see both plays, but we weren't allowed to talk to each other about the shows or our process or how it went. And I performed on closing night. So all of my friends that had done it, many of whom, by the way, I am huge fans of and like grew up watching and still watch just with amazement because they're incredible performers. we weren't allowed to talk about it or anything. So I got a call and they were like, here, you're doing this play. And here are a couple of props that you can use, but you can use your own if you want. And we'll see you tomorrow. And it was, I've never done a solo performance. And I love Hamlet. It's one of my favorite shows. One of my favorite plays of all time. And it was really scary, but really fun.
So yeah. Did you literally do Hamlet all by yourself? Or play just one character in it?
So the play that I can't remember exactly what it was called, but I played Yorick, who is the character. Oh, sorry about that.
You're good.
I played Yorick, which is the character that you never see on stage because they are the skull that in the iconic Hamlet gesture of him holding the skull up. That skull belongs to Yorick, who used to take care of Hamlet when he was a young boy. And he died and was buried in this grave. And this gravedigger is digging a hole in the ground for somebody else who dies. And not that I really need to, like, keep any spoilers or anything. This play's been around for, like, 400 years. But he finds Yorick's skull in the ground. And, yeah, so my character was basically this dead person who's talking about Hamlet and talking about the whole play.
Oh, okay.
But the other show... It was really hard because it was supposed to be funny, and it can be really easy to be funny, but it can also be really hard to be funny when you've only got 24 hours, you know? So it's like...
True.
I just had to really not overthink it, but come up with a couple of really good bits and feel everything else out with the audience and just kind of feel their vibe. Luckily, I went... after the first play, which was the more difficult one in terms of what the fuck do I do? It was Hamlet, the entire script, but only the operative words. So each character's operative words, which are just the most basically important words in a Shakespearean text, like in a line, whether it's verse or prose, if it has, like, if you were to take out every other word except for one per line and still convey the meaning of what you're saying, that would be like the operative words. And so that's what the playwright did. But they also didn't they didn't say which character was saying the line, and they didn't offer any stage directions. I was pretty lucky because I got stage directions.
Oh, my God.
But the other one was just like this super avant-garde Hamlet. It was so – it sounded really cool. I wasn't actually able to watch because I was backstage getting ready. But it was so cool, and I am grateful to this day that I did not have that piece because – it would have really scared me.
So here's a question, just to make sure I fully comprehend what you just told me, especially involving operative words. If I were Darth Vader saying, "No, I am your father," would father be the operative word, or would I be the operative word?
That's a really good question. I would say father is the operative word. And that's because the point of what Darth Vader is saying in that moment is that he is Luke's father. It's not that he exists. It's that he is the father. The point is that he's father. You know what I mean?
Gotcha. If there was ever a staged rendition of Star Wars and I needed to rehearse within 24 hours, I'd be fine. I can tell you that right now. I would be 100% fine. I've had very little, but very good Shakespearean training from Carlisle DePriest, who I hope one day I get to have on this show, but she will be on One Shot's D&D Character Podcast whenever I get season two started. But there were, I don't think we ever went over operative words, at least not to my knowledge. I still have notes laying around in my phone.
Yeah.
But what I really studied for, the show that I studied for in that workshop with her was Richard the Third.
Oh, that's what I love. Richard the Third.
And the two things that I really wanted to keep in mind, because I was doing the whole you would think after memorizing and trying to get it all down in your brain, you would remember at least a sentence off the top of your head. But It's when he's trying to get that girl he really loves,
oh,
but he also
yeah.
killed her husband, and mm-hmm. it was like, "Be with me or kill me," and oh gosh,
oh,
I feel
I
so bad
my,
that I don't remember.
Oh, I can replay it in my head. Fowler toast. She like is it before or after she says.
Those eyes of thine draw mine soft tears. Yes.
Would they were
shame.
Poison.
Yes, yes, yes. Oh, gosh. It's slowly coming back to my subconscious.
That's one of my favorites. See, I love Richard III. It's one of my favorite Shakespeare's, too. It's so good. I'm very excited about the new series Funimation is doing, where Richard is a character.
I am too.
I'm very excited about that.
I really want to see who all's going to play the characters in the dub. That's what I'm really like.
Me too.
Who's going to be who for this? Because this is a really neat idea. But what really sold me on wanting to go for Richard III, because there were a lot of others that I was curious about, especially after going through the Sandman graphic novels from Neil Gaiman, which have Shakespeare playing a huge role two stories. There's a third that he cameos in, but they mainly involve A Midsummer Night's Dream and The Tempest. Mm-hmm. So I was mostly curious about those two for the sake of having a bit more of an appreciation for those stories after experiencing the way they tie into Sandman so well. Mm. But then I saw that there was a version of Richard III where Benedict Cumberbatch was playing him.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't say no. The Hollow Crown.
Yes, with Sophie Okonedo.
I wouldn't call it an episode. It was like a movie, basically.
Yeah, it's like a miniseries.
And I loved it. I was very enamored by it. And ever since then, I've wanted to check out more of these really great cinematic renditions of Shakespearean plays. And of course, I keep finding them and I don't really sit down and watch them because they're long. And there's two that I found one of which I may actually watch tomorrow because I will be recovering from my booster shot. I found a version of Hamlet that David Tennant stars in.
Oh, yeah. That one's good.
I saw that and I was like, that's only $5 on Amazon. Buy. Just buying that right now. And the other one that I've really been wanting to check out ever since talking about it with John Christie, who was on the show many weeks ago, he and I talked about Patrick Stewart playing Macbeth in a World War II setting.
Yeah, that's on Amazon, I think.
I found it on there. My parents have a PBS subscription, so that's what made it
nice.
Easily accessible for me there. So if I can, I'd like to watch both this weekend if possible.
Yes.
Because I've been meaning to for so long, and this whole conversation really makes me want to just dive in. But also, I have a very silly reason for wanting to finally go through Macbeth. I also have a Klingon version of Macbeth in my Kindle.
Oh my gosh. That's amazing.
It literally has like a few pages of actual Macbeth. All right, no. No, it's Hamlet. Shit, it's Ham. I think it's actually Hamlet because
that works too.
Yes, because they call it Camlet in the book. but they have like the regular translation in a few pages, and then they go to the Klingon translation and then back and forth throughout the rest of it. And it's really funny, the sort of world building reason as to why this was originally a Klingon play that got stolen by the Federation and turned into Hamlet and all this sort of stuff. It's hysterical, but I almost kind of wish there was an English rendition of the Klingon translation, so that way I know exactly what they're saying,
because
there's obviously different terminologies with it being on a different planet. And some of the stuff I looked up for it made me laugh my ass off. It's so fun, but I'm also like, I feel like I would really want to dive into this a whole lot more if I really just experienced the full show.
Yeah.
And that's why I want to get into the David Tennant rendition, but also, of course, the Patrick Stewart one for Macbeth. Macbeth's been quoted in so many things. I'm like, dude, you might as well.
Yeah, I really want to see the Tragedy of Macbeth, the new Ethan Coen.
Yes,
with,
me too.
With Frances McDormand and Denzel Washington. And I've heard that that everyone's very good, but Catherine Hunter, who plays all three witches, is a performer that I really admire. She played Puck in the Julie Taymor production of Midsummer, and was so good. She just does work with her body and voice that, I mean, she is just a true stage actor, that a true character actor too. Like, she just puts every ounce of herself and just makes these very interesting choices. She also played Mrs. Fig in Harry Potter. So if you I think in Order of the Phoenix, when Harry and I think it's Order of the Phoenix, when Harry and Dudley are in the tunnel and the Dementors come and she's like, better come quick or something like that. That's Catherine Hunter as well. She has a very distinct, very deep voice.
I will have to watch that again because it's been a long time since I've watched any of the Harry Potter movies.
Yeah. Another Hamlet production that I watched really recently. Actually, I watched it when I was getting ready for the Hamlet project, is if you ever watched Fleabag or Sherlock, he was also
definitely
in a couple
Sherlock.
Of other shows, but Andrew Scott, who plays the hot priest. Yeah. He's amazing. He plays Hamlet in a production that was, filmed live, and it is so good. He is just stunning. It went pretty viral. A video of him doing the "to be or not to be" speech, which my acting teacher hated that video of him doing that. And I kind of see why, because there's a big emphasis on like letting the words flow and not getting stuck. But I think that was just taken out of context and triggered a lot of people who trained professionally as actors. When you see the whole performance, it's like, gosh, that is the level of desperation that Hamlet should be at. And I think David Tennant does that very well, too. But Andrew Scott was an incredible Hamlet. And if you or if anybody listening ever watched Downton Abbey, the actress who plays Ophelia played Sybil. And she is the best Ophelia I have ever seen. Ever,
nice.
Like in any production. She is so good. And another Shakespeare you should keep an eye out, especially if you can watch on PBS. Harriet Walter, who is incredible, and you might recognize her from a million things. She was in a production of Julius Caesar. She plays Brutus. It's an all-female production of Julius Caesar. And it was done in the UK. It's set in a women's prison. And actually, it was a whole concept where they worked with a women's prison, where this actual series of three plays was worked on by these female, by these women who were incarcerated. And so they do, I think, Henry IV. They do Henry IV, Julius Caesar, and The Tempest. And it's very good.
Nice. I am writing it down to look up later because I really want to. That actually sounds really fascinating. And Julius Caesar is a play I have been interested in for a while because we were talking about The Godfather before we started talking about all this. It's one of the few things I can think of where I actually remember seeing something in one of my English classes back in high school, where it had Marlon Brando and Al Pacino playing the same guy, just in different shows. And they were playing, I think they were both playing Caesar. I could be wrong,
but they were
at least in two different Julius Caesar productions. And I just thought to myself, I would love to see Pacino as Caesar. That would be amazing. Or even Brutus. That would be great too.
yeah. Sorry.
He would fit very well in Shakespeare related things, which I'm sure he was probably trained in that too, as I'm sure Marlon Brando was too. But there's a lot of actors that, like, the more you start to learn about those aspects of Shakespeare, the more you go, oh, I'm sure they probably liked that and that and all that stuff. And but the only other one that I've been very curious about. There's two I'm curious about that I'd like to mention to you, and I don't know if you've seen them. There was one, I think, back in the late 70s where Ian McKellen was Macbeth. And there's a bunch of other people that pop up. I'm blanking on some of the names, but like some people started just popping up on stage. I think even, I want to say Judi Dench might have been in it too.
Oh, was it with the Royal Shakespeare Company?
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, you can, on YouTube, they have the acting classes taught by John Burton, who was the artistic director of Royal Shakespeare Company, and he trained Ian McKellen, and or he was the director and guided Ian McKellen, Patrick Stewart, Judi Dench, Jeremy Irons. Gosh, there are so many, but yeah, sorry, go ahead. I love nerding out about Shakespeare.
that's the one I wanted to watch, and I started it while I was sleepy because I was like, I wanted to see how far I can get, and it was not a good idea because you kind of need to be mentally prepared for Macbeth, I feel.
Yeah.
Just from the initial 10 minutes, I'm like, yeah, I would need to be like, I've got the whole afternoon open. I can do this. But I'm also like, I want to see Patrick Stewart do it too. So I do feel like, because also another thing I really liked about what they showed briefly for the Ian McDermott version, not Ian McDermott, Ian McKellen version, was like, it felt like you were watching it from the play with, you know, smoke and all this other stuff and cameras, but it still felt like a pretty cinematic version of just seeing the play if you were there at the theater, which was very cool. And then the other one, there's another David Tennant one I'm really interested in, and that's Midsummer Night's Dream, where I think, I could be wrong, but he's also with the woman who played Donna in Doctor Who. And if that's true, because I remember having that link for a while, and I'm like, where did it go? Which I think I could legitimately rent it somewhere online. But when I found out those two were in it, which I think she really is in it. I know he's in it, but I think she is too, because I love those two in Doctor Who. If they're in a Shakespeare play bouncing off each other, I'd have to see it. And
yeah,
it needs to happen at some point there. So with all of that said, with everything going on with Shakespeare and everything else that we have talked about, I can now finally ask you what is usually my first question in the show. What got you started in voice acting?
Yeah, so as I said earlier, I was trained as a stage actor. That's how I got started. I've been stage acting since I was a little kid. And I went to a school called Stephen F. Austin's. I went to a school called Stephen F. Austin State University. And mm-hmm. It's just a tiny little town. I had a theater scholarship. My parents were like, we're not paying for a fancy school. So I went. And I wasn't expecting a whole lot, I'll be honest. but I had an acting teacher named Zach Hanks, who is a voice actor. He has done a lot of video games. He was in Battleborn, also in Call of Duty. He plays Captain McMillan.
Hold on. Did you say Battleborn or Bloodborne?
Battleborn.
Oh, okay. If you would have said Bloodborne, I would have lost my mind.
Oh, no. I'm sorry to have gotten your hopes up. No, he was in Battleborn. I think he played the Marquis. And he was also Captain McMillan in Call of Duty. He's done a lot of stuff. I think that he did some stuff for, like, honestly, I can't remember. Honestly, it's been a long time. But anyways, Zach taught a voice acting class, and he kind of, you know, He taught a theater speech class first, and that was something I took my freshman year of college. And he kind of approached me and was basically like, hey, you have a really good voice. We should talk about voice acting. And he kind of took me under his wing for the next 4 years. I mean, he kind of became my mentor. And actually, when he was recording Battleborn, was recording it here in Dallas at Okotron, and he called me and was like, hey, do you want to be my intern and sit in on this recording session and, you know, like see how it's done? And so I actually got to go to the studio and watch him record and stuff. And that was like my first time in a recording studio, and I got to meet, I can't remember who I met. I think I might have met Sabat, honestly. I think I met Chris Sabat.
Oh, Chris Sabat?
Yeah.
That's cool.
I'm pretty sure I met him. I can't remember, honestly. It was one of those things where I was like so excited to be there. And I kind of blacked out because I was so nervous. Because I was still in college and I had a really bad habit as a young 20-year-old of putting all adults on pedestals, and especially if they were professional actors. And I just was so nervous being around all of these people that were like professionals and doing such cool work that I just totally blacked out and was like, oh, cool, I can have a soda from this kitchen. That's really cool. What? am I in LA? And I was like in Plano, But yeah. So Zach pretty much got me started. I took a voice acting class with him. And every time I book something, I tell him, because I'm always like, hey, hope I'm making you proud. Yeah. So
that's so cool.
He pretty much got me started. But I didn't get involved with Funimation until I started becoming friends with Caitlin Glass and Sean Gann, basically, and Mike McFarland. We did like holiday sing-alongs at the same theater place. It's kind of like a theater church here. It's not really a church. It is a church, but it's like a renovated church that is now a theater art space. And they have like a holiday sing-along. And that's how I met Caitlin and Sean and Mike.
That's really amazing that it all just led into that and to get to that point. And now you've gotten to be in two really cool shows. One, and if I haven't said this to you already, I'm sure I've probably mentioned it to you, but I do think Hori Miya is one of the best English dubs I've heard for an anime.
Oh wow!
And I've watched a lot of anime over the last few years. I wouldn't say I'm like a major connoisseur of anime for sure. But I always like to listen to the dubs to kind of learn about how do people handle matching with the flaps? How does it all work with that? And now with being a voice actor, I wanted to kind of learn more about that and just seeing how it was going. And there were just every single person that I heard in that show, I couldn't imagine someone else doing them. So That was my really enjoyable experience there, but it just makes me happy when I see a whole lot of other people being like, yeah, the show is fantastic and y'all are doing a great job. And I definitely want to rewatch the show this year at some point.
Oh, yay!
And there's not a lot of anime I go back and watch a second time, but that's one I really want to rewatch. I'm so glad that show got me to be aware of you and Marissa, and it's such a good show. And I was honestly quite surprised to see how much of an impact the original source material had in Japan, and then seeing this be such a big break for you and Marissa for sure.
Yeah.
Just in case y'all don't know, we're both friends with Marissa Duran. She's awesome, and hopefully we'll be on the show at some point. It was definitely something that I know at one day it would be cool to be an anime. That would be fun to do at some point, but y'all really knocked it out of the park, and I'm sure many people have mentioned to you that, you know, one of the big standout scenes was your crying scene. Which that happens a little later in the show, but you guys will know when you get to that part going, oh, we're here now. Oh my God. Oh my God. I'm just very curious, what's it like when you're getting directed in a Funimation dub and being told to go there? Is it pretty similar to what you would experience with most other acting situations? Or because you now have to not only go for this emotional situation, but you got to match what's going on screen too. What's that like to go through?
Yeah. And another really hard aspect of it is, and I would say it's the hardest part about it, is that You don't always get it in one take. So, yeah, I would say that my my training as an actor and for how long I've been doing it really helped. I will say, like, I'm not trying to brag here. It's actually kind of embarrassing when it happens, but I'm very good at crying. as an actor, I'm very good at, like, just crying. I don't know. Just reaching that place. I think that's just because I'm a pretty emotional person when it comes to, like, watching shows and reading stories. I cry during movies and TV shows and everything. So it's a lot easier to cry when you have that disposition and you know what this character is going through, especially since I've been, you know, with her the whole time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, getting to that crying place, it's actually very easy. I just have to breathe and not overthink it and just, like, you know, really live in that moment with her. And, you know, I don't, like, really have to take it much further than that, than just, like, living the truth of her situation and her feelings, and, you know, a little bit of breathing technique helps. But another thing that really helped was that day Sean Gann was directing me, and Sean is somebody, he was our assistant director, and Sean mm-hmm. is somebody that I have just worked with so much. And I mean, one of my first auditions when I came back to Dallas was for Sean, and he's just somebody that I feel so comfortable around. We've been scene partners so many times that it's hard to not feel just very comfortable around him. And that's something that's really helpful, is when you are going to that place of just total desperation, with somebody that makes you feel safe and, you know, you don't feel like they're judging you. Like, at no point did I feel insecure about my crying scene, because I knew that Sean would, I guess, give me grace if it wasn't something, if it wasn't in the direction that he wanted. We did go a couple of, I did the first take, and it was pretty intense. And Sean was like, "You got another one in you." And I was like, I texted him actually, and like in that moment, I texted him and I sent him like the Britney Spears like nodding her head and crying gif. And I was like, yes, I can do it. And I think I did three takes of the crying scene. But yeah, I would say that the only hard part was that it was just exhausting. It was just physically exhausting.
I am sure. I actually wondered how many takes that would have been for a situation like that. And three was less than I had expected, which is great, because then you don't have to go for four or five like I thought it was going to be. Because there's obviously the, you got to stay true to it. You got to make sure you do well with it. But I'm also wondering, like, did you have to look at the footage at the same time to make sure that, because I remember her, you know, having her hands over her head, so that kind of helps. But,
yeah, that helped a lot.
But I'm like, I'm just kind of picturing just and at the same time, just moving your hands away just to make sure, like, am I seeing this correctly?
Well, luckily, I don't think she has a whole lot of mouth flaps that are seen when she's actually, like, mm-hmm. crying. I think that she starts out, you can see her whole face, but I think as it grows, she kind of sinks in and slumps into herself and, like, buries her face in her hands. Mm-hmm. I think. I haven't watched it in a while, but I'm pretty sure that that's what she does. So
I want to say that's right.
Super hard matching the flaps. It was mostly just really exhausting.
Oh, yeah. And I just really love the arc that you had for her in it too. That was a very good character arc. So all
Thank
of you,
you
listening, if none of you have watched Hori Mia yet, definitely highest recommendation I could give, especially if you're like, I don't have the Funimation app. Well, that's a reason to at least get a free trial, check it out there, Hell, if it's ever on Blu-ray, that would be a worthy
Blu-ray. I think it's
Blu-ray.
On Hulu, too.
Oh, yes, it's on Hulu.
It's
so you
on
can
Hulu.
Do that on Hulu. Yes, I remember trying to get a friend started on there, and I was like, oh, it's on Hulu. You could totally watch it on there now.
Yeah, I was really excited because my family is so supportive. They're really wonderful. But I'm not going to, like, make them get it. They don't watch anime. You know, like, my dad doesn't really watch much TV as it is. Neither does, like, my grandma. She doesn't really watch anime, so I'm not going to, like, make her, you know, get a Funimation account. And I'm already mm-hmm. sharing my account with, like, my sister, who actually does watch anime, and my mom, and my brother, who, you know, will watch all of my shows and stuff. But, you know, I can only share so many screens. So I was really excited when it reached Hulu, so that not only because, you know, it's very cool to, like, have your voice on Hulu, but it was also just a really great way for my loved ones to be able to watch it without having to pay, you know, a monthly fee for something that they're only going to watch one series off of.
And this is my last question involving Horimiya and voice acting. Have you actually gotten to watch Horimiya in the same room with your loved ones at some point already?
Oh, yeah. I mean, my boyfriend, we watched them, like, you know, I'm kind of excited about being a voice actor and, like, doing Funimation shows. And, you know, Alex grew up watching Funimation, and so it's pretty cool for him to hear his girlfriend's voice, you know. Mm-hmm. So we actually watch the episodes as they air, and, you know, we'll usually watch it with our breakfast, or we were at the time because we were both at home, not working. And yeah, so we watched them together. And that was pretty cool. It was very exciting. There were times I didn't get to watch them, like, with my mom or with my sister in the room. My sister lives in Seattle now, but I could always tell when they were watching them because I would get a text, and it would be like a sound that I made that was like, that sounds like Celeste, you know, like, there are a lot of them in Saint's Magic Power is Omnipotent because that character is very close to me, but like sounds like or something like that, like that's a Celeste sound. So, and there was one word that I said, there was a, I don't know if I should talk about this actually, but there was one herb that I say in one of the shows, and I was told to say it a certain way, and my mom sent me a voice message, like, saying it the way that I said it, but she ended it with, like, Celeste, you know, like, she knew how to, it was the word galangal, and I said galangal. And she was like, Galangal Celeste. And I was like, I know, they told me to say it like that. I know it's Galangal. Like, it's, you know, yeah. So my family usually lets me know when they watch it.
And now, I now have one more voice acting question to ask, because I really feel like I should ask this, because I don't know if I've had someone on this show before that's gotten to this point yet, but what does it feel like to be the lead in a Funimation anime? Because that's amazing.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, when I got the email, I was like, I don't know how much of this I should say. When I got the email that I was playing Say, I was in my car waiting to pick up a pizza from Domino's. Obviously, this was over the summer mm-hmm. before I was diagnosed. But I was waiting to pick up a pizza from Domino's, and I had, like, no money. I was feeling so down because I just, like, I had just finished my shows, like, all of my work, and I didn't have anything, like, lined up. And I was just in this point where I felt like, hey, I should, you know what, I'm just going to go apply for the Tex-Mex restaurant nearby that just opened up. Because I was just, I didn't have anything going on. So it was very exciting. And I would just, I mean, the people that worked on that show with me are so good. Like, David and Ian are just such wonderful scene partners to have. Ian is just lovely. He plays Albert.
Oh, yeah.
And so, just so wonderful. David Matrenga plays another character. And then Ryan Levy, who's an angel.
Yes.
That, like, the world just is obsessed with right now because he's just incredible. He's very talented and also just such a wonderful, kind person. He was in that show. And so it was just really... It was kind of scary, honestly, because it was, I mean, I had done Walla and some, you know, additional kind of characters in some other shows, but like as a recurring character, this was like my third show and it was a lead. And that was terrifying because I was like, you know, even though I've been a stage actor for most of my life, voice acting in a way is its own world. And I was like, am I ready for that? Can I do that really? But they made it so easy because, I mean, not that it was easy. It was actually very hard sometimes, but they were so wonderful to, they would just play off of whatever I said if I recorded first or if I recorded after them. They would just give me so much to work with. And that's, you know, like your scene partners are your greatest, I guess, tool.
That's so inspiring. I'm really happy that you shared that. And anyone listening, obviously, check out that show too. I may have to continue also.
It's really fun. I felt very close to the character, but I also felt like I was playing my sister because my sister is a major book nerd, but a bookworm. She's a major bookworm, but she also is a microbiologist. And so she's just and really loves plants. Like, she used to mostly work with plants. And so I just felt like I was playing her, basically.
Does she like to cook as well?
Oh, yeah. She's an amazing cook. Yeah, I would say that Say is probably closer to being my sister than me, but, you know.
And now I gotta ask, what got you started on cooking?
Well, everybody in my family is a really good cook. I have a huge family. My mom is one of seven. She's the youngest.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, my dad is like just him. He's an only child of only children. But my mom is part of a huge family, and all of my aunts and uncles have children of their own. Some of them have grandchildren. One of them has great grandchild, and all of them can cook. It's just because of my grandmother, and my grandmother is 101. She's our matriarch. You know, she's the mother of all of my mother's siblings and taught everybody how to cook. She taught me how to cook. She taught my mom and my sister. She taught us all, you know, even, I mean, my first memories of cooking are in her kitchen. And actually, like, her father... it runs in our family, too. Cooking is such a big part of us. My grandmother's father was a cook in World War II. Like, that was his – like, he's a veteran of World War II. He was a cook, which I think is so cool. He also had a restaurant in Ennis, which is a small town south of Dallas. And his father was a cook on a on a wagon train. Like those, like the covered wagon trains.
Yeah.
They would like carry around, they would bring a cook around with them. And yeah, so like everyone in my family is a cook basically. And like, it's just very good at it. So, yeah.
That's really cool. My mom and her side of the family, especially with her mom / my grandmother, that's kind of where the cooking stuff, I guess, got passed down to me, Whereas, I mean, my dad's mom cooked. He doesn't really, he does some cooking himself, mainly with black eyed peas and pork chops and such. I do really like how he does black eyed peas, but he has a very weird taste in food. Like, he doesn't like cheese or steaks that are medium rare or anything like that. But
oh, really?
He's a well done guy.
I know.
And I used to make those for him whenever I would get around to actually making steaks later in life. And it felt good to be able to go, you know what, you get that, and I'm just going to have myself a medium well version or a medium rare version, which medium well I did grow up enjoying. I'm not usually very picky when it comes to steaks, but medium rare is my soft spot for sure.
Oh, really? I like it rare. I just want to like slice through that like butter. Yeah.
Rare is good. I do like rare. There is something a little pretty tender about medium rare that I do really enjoy. But if my steak comes out rare, I'm not going to complain. I'll be like, this is still good. This is still very good.
I feel like usually almost every time I've ordered something rare, it comes back medium rare. Like, I want it like rare. I just can't help myself, you know?
There's always that temptation of being like, I want to ask for another if it's just not exactly what I want. But having worked at a restaurant, I try to be a lot more kind as far as that's concerned. It's just like, dude, they either slipped their minds or they left it out for a little too long. Don't worry about it if everything else on your plate is still good. There was one time I went to Buffalo Wild Wings. Actually, it was the last time I went to Buffalo Wild Wings, because I told myself after this I was going to probably not go back for a long time. But I got some I wanted to get some bone-in wings with specific sauces. I don't remember what sauces they were. But then they brought out boneless with different sauces. And I was like, I'll still eat this. Because it's they are busy. They are very busy. But also it's like, you know, these sauces are actually good. And it's saving me about $2. So I'll just tell them, hey, you gave me the wrong order, but I ate it anyway. So just thank you. it saved me a couple of bucks. And it just made me want to make my own wings at home more. Which, that's kind of funny, where I feel like a lot of my inspiration for cooking usually happens if I have something kind of bland at a restaurant or not great at a restaurant, I want to try to make it better. Or it's so good, I want to find a way to replicate it at home, or at least something close to it. Has there ever been a meal that you had going somewhere where you're like, I would love to make that at home, and you did it and you were not only proud of yourself, but you made a better version?
Oh, gosh. I mean, there's definitely this. There's a Vietnamese place here in Dallas. It's just called Vietnam Restaurant. And they have a wonton soup that is, it's so good. And I, like, cannot leave Dallas until I learn how to make it just like they do. But have I ever made something that I tried to make this one dish. There is a food truck in Austin, Texas, and it's called Abu Yusuf. It is a Egyptian food truck, and they have this platter called the Gardenia platter. If you're in Austin, please go. It's on Manor Road. It's so good. It's my favorite place to eat in Austin, and Austin has incredible food. But it's this gardenia platter it has like cauliflower and tahini and eggplant and hummus. And it's the best thing I've ever had.
Nice.
Like, from a restaurant ever. It's so good. It's so flavorful. And I tried making it, and I made something that was not it, but it was very, very good still. So I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say. I wouldn't say that I've ever, like, tried to replicate something that I've had at a restaurant and made it even better. I, like, really try to respect their process and what they make.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Yeah. Sorry if that doesn't answer your question.
You're good. You are good. You're good. I was actually thinking to myself, I don't know if I have an answer for that too. It seemed like a good question at the time. There have been things where I would get inspired wanting to try to make it. Like I remember eating fish tacos at a local Mexican restaurant, and I didn't have certain things necessary to make it the way that they would likely fry them. So I just pan fried them and had them heat in the oven and such. The tilapia, which was the fish. And it was still good. It was still there were still very good tacos, but there's definitely a way they would do it over there. There's some things that they're not telling us that I would love to know. One day I would love to replicate a place I used to go to over in Knoxville, Tennessee, a whole lot. It was a roast beef platter special. I have seen only one recipe on YouTube that looks even close to how they do it. And I read through it. I don't think I've watched it yet, but I read through like the stuff you would need for it. And I thought, oh, that makes sense. And they also have like these Greek style chopped potatoes that are like,
That sounds so good.
Yeah, they're very, very good. And you can also get pita bread to go along with it. And what I would like to do, which I think one of the guys there told me, like, you should try it like this, because you can make your own sort of pita roast beef sandwich. You just chop off some of your meat and put it on top of your sandwich, fold the sandwich over, and bite. And it's so good. It's so, so good. I'm actually hungry thinking about it.
I know, I haven't had dinner yet either.
So whenever...
Wow, that sounds so good.
It's easily one of my top five favorite meals of all time, for sure. Last night, I got to have my favorite of all time, which was Outback Steakhouse loaded cheese fries.
Oh, man. Ugh, I miss cheese fries.
I'm sure you do. I'm almost like, should I talk about that?
No, totally, totally. No, I will revel in the memories of cheese fries.
I do remember John, Chris, who I had mentioned earlier, telling me like one of the reasons why he likes to listen to this show is so that he can vicariously experience all the foods that myself and my guests will talk about that he can't eat because he's going through a necessary diet as well. So it's like, I can't eat any of that, but I will, I will go through it with you guys like I am. So I'm sure he'll feel the same way. But I will say though, there's a nostalgia aspect to how good those fries are for me, but also just how they have that crisp, good crunch bite to them with Monterey Jack and cheddar cheese melted in and chopped bacon bits, and the ranch that, or whatever dipping sauce they had last night was actually surprisingly good. Like usually I'm like, I'm not crazy about that dipping sauce. They made it good last night. So I was like, I'm okay with the fact that my steak sandwich was undercooked or left out to hang for what felt like it could have been sitting out for 20 minutes, and it was like, yeah, this is not as flavorful as I was hoping it would be. But the fries were perfect. And then I also, my birria tacos are probably my favorite. That's my favorite meal I've ever made. And that's definitely one where at times I liked it more than where I had it at a local place that was open here very briefly, and they only served birria tacos once. But birria tacos are easily the best thing I've made, and I have a new way of wanting to do it after watching a video not too long ago, which I will put in the description, and I could share that video with you if you'd like to see it. It's where I would basically use where you let everything marinate for a long time, but once you're through and you take the beef out and it's easy to slice up, you slice it up. And then you let it cool down and then you put it in the fridge. So that way all of the fat will start to just rise up and become that solid top for everything. take that out, put it somewhere else. And rather than where I would usually like dip my shell, my tortillas in the broth mixture, I'm planning on my next time cooking them, I'm going to have my tacos already being cooked in my skillet or wherever I cook them in, which is probably going to be a skillet with where I am right now, and put some of the cold fat solid stuff in the skillet with them to allow it all to mix that way.
Oh, yeah.
Because that just looked not only great, but it also has a much greater chance of not having your tortilla shells fall apart on you.
Oh, yeah.
Especially if you're using corn tortillas, which I love me some corn tortillas. And I think my only other really huge thing that I really love that I haven't made in a long time, and I'm going to make it next week, is enchiladas.
Mmm. My mom makes really good enchiladas.
Now, does your
mom... What do you like to put in yours? Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, like, does your mom like to do where it's more Tex-Mex or more traditional?
What do you mean?
Well, I've seen two different ways. I've seen two different ways. The way I like to do it is where everything's inside. You could still do sauce and cheese on top, but your protein, like your chicken, which I like to have in my enchiladas, and maybe rice as well. I should try beans next time too. Put all that in your enchiladas, in the inside, and then add it in your sauce and your extra cheese on top. But I've also seen where, especially in the local place I go to, they actually have only cheese inside the enchiladas, and then they have like steak or chicken or shrimp on top. As well as all the other stuff, like a diced tomato or sour cream or whatever else you want.
What? Huh. So, my family is Mexican American. We are like literally Tex-Mex. Like we are Texas Mexicans.
Gotcha.
And my mom, that's on my mom's side. So it really, the way that my mom does it is, and this, it changes depending on if she's in a rush, like, or how much she's trying to make. But she'll take the corn tortilla and she'll fry it up a little bit in like some, just to soften it and kind of, when you're working with corn tortillas, you know, it's important to like put it in a shallow pan of hot oil just for a little bit, just like flip it around in there just to get it soft because it won't break as easily. So she does that and then she'll dip it in her sauce that she makes. And she'll roll it. And she usually, depending on what we have or depending on the season, there's always cheese in it. But sometimes she'll put chicken if she has it. What I really love is when it's hatch pepper season, my mom will, she has a fire pit in our backyard or in her backyard.
Ooh.
And she will roast the hatch peppers over the fire. So they've just got this delicious smoky flavor. And she'll like peel them and then slice them. And put them in with the cheese. Sometimes chicken goes in there. Sometimes she'll add sautéed Swiss chard, which is really good. Swiss chard in cheese enchiladas is so good.
That sounds amazing.
It's just so delicious. So, yeah, she'll put, like, the cheese or and chicken or hatch peppers or Swiss chard, whatever she's got, and then she'll roll them. And basically just repeat and fill up the whole dish. But sometimes if she's ever like low on time or she's trying to make like just a ton, she'll do it in layers, kind of like she's doing a lasagna or something. But usually like I think she prefers to do it where she rolls it. But I've never had rice and beans in the enchilada. That might be, I don't know, maybe it's a regional thing, but I've never had it before. That sounds really good. I love all Mexican food. So, yeah.
That's definitely some aspects to think about including in my next enchiladas. I normally have made them where I use like really giant flour tortillas. So that way they're just these big, big enchiladas. Like maybe only five can fit in one dish. And you can eat like 2.5 with another person and the other person can have 2.5 and you're good. You have a meal right there.
Yeah.
And
I operate under the belief that this might be a controversial opinion, but I operate under the belief that corn tortillas is just corn tortillas for enchiladas. But I have had them with flour tortillas, and I will say that it is delicious.
It is. It really is.
But it is purely like a
purist
kind of thing.
I do love corn tortillas. Technically, more as a flavor option over flour. I find flour to be just a little bit easier to work with. But what you did mention about, you know, dipping in the oil, that was something I saw with that same video I'd mentioned about the birria tacos. I'm like, okay, that's something I should do because I didn't really think about that.
Yeah, they won't break as easily, and they'll taste better too. You know, they'll be a little bit, it's just like the texture will just be so good. Yeah, not too much oil, just enough. You just kind of want it to sizzle. And just kind of be softer and nice and golden.
And now I really want to ask this question because I am really hungry and I would love to eat food, and I'm sure you do too. What is your favorite recipe?
Whew. Okay, so I thought about this, and I have to go with, there is a, I don't know if you're familiar with Jacques Pepin. But he is a legendary chef. He used to have his own cooking show. He was very, very popular in like the 90s. He would sometimes work with Julia Child. And my aunt, one of my aunts who lived with us when I was a kid, this is going back to me talking about like what got me into cooking and my family and stuff. But my aunt lived with us when I was a really little kid. And she and I would just hang out. She was like my cool aunt. And we would watch episodes of Jacques Pepin because she was obsessed with him and she had all of his cookbooks. She like just thought he was the best chef, you know, and he is. He's so good. He's a French chef, French-American chef, and he has just totally changed French cooking in America. And just made it so accessible. And he actually runs. Sorry, I'm getting off topic, but I promise I'll get back to it. More about Jacques Pepin. He has a nonprofit for teaching, providing cooking classes and cooking lessons to like people who might not have access to it. So that's like including like people who are currently like incarcerated or people who didn't get to go to school or didn't get to finish school. People who have otherwise like just difficult lives that don't allow them to learn how to make just like gourmet food that is, and he makes it cheap. Like he puts a huge emphasis on making it affordable and how like exquisite cooking is something that should be provided to every person of every economic level, you know, like every single person should know how to cook. So anyways, I really like Jacques Pepin as well. And I grew up watching him and he had this spinach potato galette that my aunt would make. And it was like my favorite thing to eat when I was like 5 years old. And it's still one of my favorite meals ever. It's so good. It's so simple. It's a galette, so it's just made with like finely sliced potatoes and spinach, olive oil, salt, black pepper, and you basically you saute the spinach and you line like a dish, like a casserole dish or like a pie dish with the very thinly sliced potatoes, and you just do layers of like thin potato, spinach, thin potato and spinach. And you bake it for a while. So the outer potato gets really nice and golden and crispy. And then the inner potato is just really tender and delicious. And it is so good. I can also eat it with my like crazy diet restrictions. And it is so delicious.
That sounds remarkable.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, that sounds so remarkable. In fact, while you were talking, like I had to look up pictures just to see what that looks like. And oh,
did you find any?
Really videos. I found videos and I hope I spelled it right. G A L-E-T-T-E?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it is.
There's one that popped up in the middle of a screenshot that I'll send you, but oh, it's not the spinach one because the video up top just started playing like crazy and such. But this one right here, it just looks like something I would create a bed version and just want to sleep on it and then devour it as I am sleeping. It is.
Yeah.
Just look at. Okay, it popped up. Look at that.
Oh, that looks delicious.
Yes. I'll share that screenshot with you guys too, just so that you or better yet, I'll share with you the video link for that because I'm going to be looking at that, watching that video tonight.
I will also ask my sister to take, it's funny because I texted my sister asking about like what her favorite meals were from like our childhood and stuff. Because it's just been really hard to think about food recently since I've like had to stop eating so many different things. It's like all I think about is what I can eat. And it just has really interfered with like creativity in the kitchen. I'm working through that. But I had already thought about the spinach galette. And the first thing that she brought up was the galette. And she was like, that's really funny you asked because I just picked up groceries to make that very thing tonight. So I'll ask her to take a picture and I'll send it to you because it's just very special. It's so delicious.
Well, I'm honored that you're going to... I was just going to say, I'm honored that you would send that to me.
Of course. I mean, it's like you... I know so many... kids that or I know so many parents of children that like will only eat chicken nuggets and french fries and mac and cheese and stuff and it's, you know, this is a dish that was like my favorite meal at 5 years old, you know, so it's like this is that's how good it is that it could turn or maybe it just like says how much of a foodie I am. I don't know, either way it's so good.
I can't wait to see that picture. And I'm so excited about diving into something that I've not even considered trying to make before. Like that seems completely fresh to me. So I'm really, really excited to do that. And that's just one of the beautiful things about food is that there's so much of it out there that being able to talk to wonderful people like you and get into these really neat recipes and everything, it just makes me feel you can feel in a lot of ways that cooking is just as rewarding of an experience sometimes from a creative standpoint as acting is too, because you'll just look at what you've put together and go, I'm amazed I made that. And it's so good.
Oh, yeah.
It is so good. Oh.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that if I hadn't worked in a restaurant before and if I didn't know how hard it was to be a cook, I would probably want to be a cook, you know, like if I couldn't ever act again, I would probably choose that because it is so, yeah, it's magic. And I also think that food is one of the, I mean, I think everybody needs to know how to cook. And should have a good palate for truly good food. And that can mean anything. But because it's the thing that makes us humans, you know? Like, it is the only thing that really, like, defined humanity. And, you know, like, we have... It's one of the only things that we absolutely, like, had... to learn to do in order to progress as a species, you know? And so, and it also just tells so much history. I mean, yeah, the history of food is a whole other podcast. Yeah.
That is true. And I really don't know what I can say to top a statement like that. That in and of itself is worthy of a closing statement on such a wonderful conversation with you, Celeste. Thank you so much for coming on to Voices That Cook and talking amazing food and Shakespeare and your incredible acting experiences, whether they be on stage or in a booth or at Funimation. I am so happy we got to finally do this. Definitely one of the top people I wanted to have on the show. And I feel like I can kind of, I kind of got like a milestone crossed off on my list there. So here's hoping.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. And here's hoping at some point in the future, because I am going to be visiting the Dallas area again, because I do I do plan to move there. Primarily Lewisville. That's where I'm thinking about moving to with a friend of mine. Hopefully one day I can make you something that will be delicious as well.
Yes.
And before we go off and bid our adieus, where can the listeners of One Shot, not One Shots, that's a different show, William. Where can the listeners of Voices That Cook follow you?
Oh, yes. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is Celez Perez. That is CelezPerez. And my Instagram is the exact same thing, but it has a middle initial, which is A in the middle. I think that's right. Let me double check.
Yeah, let's double check that. Let's
should really. Yeah, I was right.
There you go. Yeah. I'm glad we checked on that, because it will be in the description below. That needs to be correct in there, especially for future William. And if you want to follow me or future William, you are welcome to do so on Instagram at The Voice That Cooks and on Twitter at Voice That Cooks. And do be sure to, you know, obviously follow both of us on Instagram for all the food posts and such. But definitely keep up with our voice acting endeavors as well and all that good stuff. And yeah, I'm so thrilled that this got to work out so well. And my computer has not died. So we are good. We are very good. So
yeah, thanks so much for having me.
You are welcome. You're welcome, my friend. And if for all of you who have been listening, thank you so much for listening. And if you're listening to this on an app that lets you review the show, please do leave us a review and let us know what you think of the show and the interview and all that good stuff. And of course, definitely check out Hori Mia. The saint is, oh gosh, that title is very long.
the saint's magic power is omnipotent.
Yes, it's almost a title that I feel like could work as an album name as well.
for sure, yeah.
Check out both shows, and I'm sure you've got other great stuff coming up that we will be all excited about in the future too, whether it's something you've booked already or not that you can't talk about or whatever. I'm going to be rooting for you for whatever you do next. And yeah, I think that's about going to do it, I guess. Well, hopefully that will line up well with the music that's playing as the show wraps up there. But seriously, thank you all so much for listening to Voices That Cook. I hope that this episode made you hungry, inspired, and maybe want to do a bit of both of the acting and cooking stuff on the side. And if you decide, ooh, I want to make that too, make that food that we talked about, feel free to share it with us. That'd be fun.
I can even send you the recipe for the galette.
Yes, please. Yes, please.
I have it because in the fourth grade, my class made a cookbook to sell at an auction, and I have it. And I chose, as a fourth grader, to submit the recipe for this galette.
I will gladly, gladly read over that when you send it. Oh my, thank you so much. And seriously, everyone, thank you for listening, and y'all have a wonderful rest of your day.